What year did you come into the business?
1961. I'm not very good at that, or two, something like that. Early 60s, anyway.
Was it inevitable? Was it?
I don't think so. It was not inevitable, but I think my father would have been disappointed if I hadn't, although he many times said, I want you, to be under no pressure to come in here. If you want to go and paint landscapes in the west of Ireland, you do what you want to do or something. But I was never put under any pressure to join. And I've always been mechanically minded. Mm-hmm. And I did mechanical engineering, but I did it down the practical route. I knew one or two of my friends went to Trinity and UCD, and I didn't think much of the courses. Yeah. They were not mechanically orientated at all. And so I went to England, and I joined an engineering company as an apprentice. And I worked there, and then you got day release after a couple of years. You'd work four evenings a week and a Saturday morning at Tech. And then on my second or third year, got day release and you could go on. I went on and I got my High National that way and my AMI McKee. And so when I left that company, I was able to, I didn't have any training to do, I'd done it. And I went then, there was a period of great development in Bishop Street at that time. And my father said, we're actually taking on two engineers at the moment. Would you think of doing that? And so I said, well, I would. Well, he said, actually, we won't be taking them on for a year or so. I think you ought to go to the Liverpool factory and work there for a year and learn a bit about biscuit making. So that was a great help to me. I went to work in Liverpool then. So when I hesitated about when did you join Jacobs, I didn't join Jacobs Dublin until about in the mid-60s. Mm-hmm. But by that stage, I'd done all my apprenticeship and got qualified and worked in the biscuit factory in England. And so when I came over here, I was able to slot straight in. And as it happened, they employed another engineer the same day. We both started the same day, and he'd come straight from Trinity. And he spent most of the time asking me, how do you do this? How do you do that? How do you do the other? So I think my decision was possibly correct.
And so your apprenticeship then would have given you new ideas. And did you apply those new ideas?
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
So what did you do?
Well, my job, I was on the drawing board to start with, obviously, and I worked and I put in, one of the first jobs was bulk chocolate. I put in that. And then the cooling systems in Jacobs were all run with ammonia cooling brine, a circulating brine around a system. This was way out of date now, centralised cooling plant. So I took all that out and put in individual Freon units in every cooling unit. And I put in chocolate moulding plants, chocolate enrobing plants, baking plants. Really, anything which was mechanical, I did it. I didn't do anything on the civil or the electrical. And wrapping machines were coming to the fore, because up to the 50s, most packets of biscuits were wrapped by hand. And not only in Dublin, but everywhere.
Yeah.
And wrapping machines were coming out, and there was a plethora of manufacturing machines, some a great deal better than others. And I made it my business. I'd go and see them all and go over the drawings and go over the machines, what ones were good, what ones weren't. And culminated then, the chief engineer retired, and I was made chief engineer, and then I was made an engineering director of Irish Biscuits, which was a subsidiary of Jacobs, the manufacturing subsidiary. And that carried on, and I was that. And then we decided to move to Tallaght. So the building was put under the auspices of the managing director, Geoffrey Jenkins, and he was responsible for getting the building done, and I was responsible for putting all the machinery into it and commissioning it and getting it going.
What was the reason to move out to Tallaght?
Cost.
In what way?
The cost of manufacturing on a multi-storey building in the middle of Dublin was prohibitive. We were getting absolutely stuck on cost. The English manufacturers all have a biscuit line to produce biscuits is probably 500 feet long. Mm-hmm. Now the oven would terminate after 200 feet, and then it would go up a system of conveyors to the next floor, and then something would happen, another system would come, and there was people employed everywhere. We had at one stage 22 lifts, I think it was. Yeah. And each lift had an operator. There were too many people.
So the new systems you were putting in place.
We were putting the new systems, and you see, all the bulk ingredients. We'd no bulk handling systems in Bishop Street, except for fat. all the sugar and the flour and everything was in bags. Well, that involves people mulling 100-weight bags around the place. So once we moved to Tallow, we put in silos. We were buying 20 tons of flour in a tanker, blowing it in, blowing it across, weighing it. And, I mean, there was a huge amount. The savings were just immense. Like
employees wise,
well, like 1,000 to 1,200 people. But we had a huge workforce. That sounds a lot for a lot of people. But in actual fact, we had very little voluntary redundancy. Mm-hmm. We had quite a lot of no compulsory redundancy, very little voluntary redundancy, because a lot of the people had worked there since the end of the 20s. Mm-hmm. And so they were all coming up to the age of retiring. So they just didn't move to Tallow. It was as simple as that. It was just tough luck that when we moved in the early 70s, inflation and went to the early 20s, and interest rates went to the 20s as well, something which the modern generation doesn't believe, but it did. And we were caught with a factory in Bishop Street, a factory in Dean's Grange, and a half-finished factory in Tallow, an interest rate of 20%. So it was a very difficult time. We had to borrow £4 million from the banks, which caused the banks no end of heartache, and we got it anyway, and we moved to Tallow, and we never seemed to manage to make any headway in chipping down this £4 million. In fact, it grew and grew, and finally the bank manager sent for the then managing director, or the finance director, Leo O'Donnell, who was a great person, and he, in my view, was the salvation of Jacobs to bring it into the next century. And he looked at what we were doing, and we just bit the bullet, and we had to let go a lot of people. But we cut out everything which wasn't making money. And the banks at one stage said to us they didn't believe we'd ever pay back the capital. And at the moment, they doubted whether we'd be capable of paying back the interest, let alone the capital. So anyhow, Leo, marvellous man, still alive, living up in Fox Rock, marvellous person. He cut out all the dead wood. He cut out the lines which were traditional and not profitable. It meant having to cut out. At this stage, we had a certain amount of export business, which we had rebuilt up under the Bolan brand. It didn't earn a halfpenny. It was strategic rather than anything. Oh, I know what it was. But we cut that. We cut a lot of that out, and a lot of soul searching. You know, we've been doing this for 100 years. We should continue doing. Cut it all out. Put the company back in a profitable footing, and we finished the Tallow factory, and then got rid of Bishop Street, got rid of Dean's Grange, and then we were on one site. Got the numbers down properly, and nobody wanted to move from Dean's Grange, which was a great help, because they all wanted to leave. And Dean's Grange factory drew its labour pool from Dunleary, and at that stage, Dunleary to Tallow was a 3/4 of an hour drive, and if you're on the bus, it was into Dublin out again with a 2-hour drive. So nobody wanted to move from there practically. About five, I think, moved, but no more. So we were able to. And we had a modern factory there, which was capable of supplying the UK market. And we did private label work for Marks & Spencer, Sainsbury's, all the big suppliers in England. Not hugely profitable, but it did take up and contribute to the overheads. The Irish market was the profitable end. But then there was only 3.5 million people in Southern Ireland and 1 million in the north or something. It's a small market for a big factory. And really, in the biscuit industry, you need to run plants 15 shifts or 15 shifts a week to make it pay. And we were only running 10 and sometimes one or two plants beyond nights and things like that. Mm-hmm. So we were always struggling. But at that stage, the labour rates were lower in Ireland than in England. And the return on capital, our return on capital was always up around 4.5%. United Biscuits, which was the biggest and best biscuit company in England, theirs was around 4.5%, but they made a lot more money with this because they had a lot more capital in the business. We kept the capital down and got the same return, and that was always our target. We could never match them on profit per turnover, but we could at least match them on return on capital, and just went on from there. And Leo O'Donnell was great, and then eventually we realised we couldn't go on forever on our own. The world was getting smaller, and we were getting very much smaller. And also, when I went into Jacobs first, there was no customer bigger than us. You know, the Dunns, the Quinsworths, they were all smaller. We had a plethora of, I forget, we had thousands, literally thousands of small customers. We had a sales force of about 60. We had a transport fleet of 120 people and about 80 vans. You know, huge costs, but the way we were working. And as we, as the marketing world changed and bigger customers, Dunns grew, Musgraves grew, Quinsworths grew, Tesco, of course, came in on us. It was more and more obvious that we couldn't carry on in a single, on our own. But it was more and more obvious also to Jacobs in Liverpool, who, as I said earlier, was a different company. So they said, look, we've got this crowd in Dublin operating under the same name. If somebody took them over, they could operate under that name and they could harm us very greatly. So they bought quietly shares on the open market until they owned up to 29%. Which was as high as they could go without making a bid for the rest of the capital. And but it had a huge problem for us. Nobody was going to come in and buy us when 29% was held by another company. So they were effectively keeping the share price down and doing nothing with it. And it was an awkward situation for us, but we just had to bite our lip. It was real life and get on with what was happening. And then Nabisco, the American company, Nabisco had a branch in Europe, Nabisco Europe, and they took over the Associated Biscuits business, which at this stage Jacobs was part of. That's Jacobs, Hunt and Palmer and Peakfreen. They took that over and rolled it into Nabisco UK. So that continued for a bit, and still Nabisco UK now held 29% of our equity. And they didn't show any signs of wanting to take it over or not wanting to take it over until they woke up one morning and found that BSN, as they call themselves, Danone, they now call themselves, the French company, bought Nabisco Europe.
Yeah.
So suddenly, by sheer accident, Nabisco UK found themselves a subsidiary of a French company, and we found ourselves a subsidiary of a French company too. So it seemed logical at the time that, well, we because they had a 29%, we had two directors of Danone, or BSN as they were then known, on our board. And it seemed sensible. It was only small money to them that in time they should take that, the remaining 81%, which we negotiated the price, and they did. And they bought it out at £5 a share, and our share price had been 170 or so. I can't remember what it was exactly, but it was a hell of a lot less than £5. But we managed to get that price. So in the end of the day, the shareholders that stuck with us through thick and thin, and there were a few thin times, particularly in the early 70s, the shareholders that stuck with us, they got a fiver a share for their shares. So they probably did as good as they'd have done anyway. Yeah. So we felt happy we'd done the right thing for the shareholders and for the employees. But at this stage, the factory was contributing well. It was supplying product into the UK. When Danone came into the scene, we were supplying product into France and Holland, Germany and Italy. So there was potential for expansion, and we felt that this was grand. We'd done a good thing. Danone, I think, had other plans.